So all these events that are happening in this current time have the potential to essentially destroy civilization. Welcome back to Mind Matters. It's just me and Adam today. I'm Harrison Cayley. And I want to talk about a few things. Well, first I'll tell you some of the things that I've been listening to recently. I listened to both an episode, these are older episodes, an older episode of Tim Pool's podcast, and an episode of the book club that Unsafe Spaces does. And both of these shows talked about the book The Fourth Turning by William Strauss, or Neil Strauss, and some other guy, can't remember. Howe and Strauss, maybe?
Yeah.
And so they were pretty good discussions. I liked both of them. And I'd been familiar with Fourth Turning and the so-called like generational theory or generations theory for a couple of years. I wrote a few articles about it back in 2016, I think. 2017. And one of the things that they were trying to figure out on both these podcasts is how to figure out these cycles of history that these guys are talking about and if they're valid or not and what that means for either predictions or for just looking at what's happened since the book was written. Because the book, they wrote The Fourth Turning in like around 97 or something like that, mid-90s. And just to give a brief overview of what the theory is, I'm pretty sure we talked about it on a previous show, but just to give another background, the idea of this theory is that it's a cyclical theory of history and of time, so that certain patterns tend to repeat themselves, and they repeat roughly on a 90-year cycle. It's not strictly limited to 90 years. It's basically the time that it takes for four generations to pass. And four generations is the length of a long life. So essentially, if you live till you're 80 or 90, you've got great-grandparents, grandparents, parents, and children. And so the interactions between these four generations, according to these guys, tend to result in repeatable patterns so that every fifth generation is like a repeat of the fifth before it. So there are certain like archetypes or trends. And this actually led to some of the criticisms against this theory that it's kind of like astrology, because you can kind of just find whatever you need and force fit it. And there may be something to that criticism, but at the same time, it does seem like a nice model in which to view things. Because if you look at this, then if you look at it in kind of like the English speaking world history for the past couple hundred years, you have major catastrophes happening right when they say they would, or when you would predict based on the theory. So you have the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, World War II, and then these days, you know? So according to this theory, the times we're living in now is the crisis period. And the crisis period is one of the four periods, because not only is it the interaction of these four generations, but the interaction of these four generations and the where they are in their significance for each specific time period. For example, if we just label the generations 1, 2, 3, and 4, if you're living in the time when generation 2 are the like adults doing things, that'll have a different flavor than if it's a number 1 or number 4. And so the trend is that you seem to have these periods of crisis. These might be periods of war or revolution or the fall of civilizations, or things just either fall apart, something bad happens, and it's usually a big crisis. It's not just a minor crisis. A crisis period is followed by a period in which society is essentially rebuilt. And so this is a constructive period. After this constructive period comes like this almost like consciousness revolution period. And then that's followed by a period of stagnation, which slides into another period of crisis. And this just repeats and repeats. So one of the ideas in this generational theory is that they're not saying that wars and revolutions and things like this only ever happen in the fourth turning. They're saying that the climate of that time means that the crisis will hit in such a way and people will react in such a way that it makes it a giant crisis. So a war can break out in any of the other periods, but it won't necessarily have the same effects that it would have if it happened in the fourth turning. And at the same time, you can have a spark, what they call a spark, like a major or a potentially major event that might happen in any of these other turnings, any of these other parts of the cycle, that might just go off like a damp squib, but when it happens in the crisis period, then things kind of, the reaction based on the people living in that time and the kind of climate of that time, turn that into a crisis. So something that, I'll get into an example that I talked about in the articles that I wrote, which was 9/11. Because the thing about the crisis is that, well, I'll back up a bit. So like I said, the current times that we live in, according to Strauss and Howe, are the fourth turning. So this is the crisis period. And according to them, it should have started in the mid to late 2000s. So like around 2008, and it'll go till just before like 2030, about 22 years, something like that, 20 to 22 years. So the things that the sparks that happen in that period will tend to produce an overblown reaction and with the potential to essentially destroy a civilization, which will then get rebuilt in some form in the generation afterwards. So this would be like in the 30s and the 40s, the 2030s and the 2040s. So one of the things that I'm pretty sure they brought up in both of these, on both of these shows, yeah, so on Tim Pool's show and on the Unsafe Spaces podcast, they were talking about what these crises, how these crises kind of fit into the theory and whether Strauss and Howe's predictions kind of came true. Because there is one paragraph it's not just one paragraph, but one paragraph's worth of material in one of the last chapters of the book where they give their predictions for what's going to happen. And they talk about like terrorism using airplanes and financial crises and collapses and a bunch of other things that kind of seem to fit, but they also talk about a bunch of stuff that never happened. And that's, so one of the criticisms on the Unsafe Spaces podcast was that it's kind of like a dartboard, you know, they're making a lot of predictions and not a lot of them fit. But I think that kind of misses the point of the book, because I think they even make it clear in the book that it's not the specific predictions that are important. It's that it's something like this. Something like this will happen. It's these types of things which could produce giant catastrophes, essentially. And so on Tim Pool's podcast, they were kind of debating what the crisis point was, whether it was 9/11 or the financial collapse in 2008, the financial crisis. And in my articles, I'd written that, from my perspective, it seems like 9/11, if it would have happened in 2008, or in any of the years since 2008, would have had a much bigger impact than it did. Of course, it did have a huge impact when you look at the wars that got started that are still going on, and the changes to even just the structure and infrastructure of the United States government, and not just the U.S. government, but kind of the entire U.S. and its allies, and the things that have happened since then. That is a big change, but it didn't radically reorient society, and we haven't, following it, there wasn't a massive rebuilding and restructuring of society. There was, you know, there were new institutions like Homeland Security and things like that, but there wasn't a massive reconstruction. What do I mean by massive reconstruction? Well, if we look at how these cycles, if they, you know, exist in the way they do, played out, you can look at something like the history of Russia in the 20th century. You had the crisis, what I think, they only talk about the Western world in fourth turning, but if you take the the framework and overlay it on Russian history, it actually matches up quite well. You have the revolutionary period in the early part of the 20th century in Russia, followed by World War II and the Russian Revolution, which completely destroyed the pre-existing Russian society and social structure. Completely destroyed it. And then it was rebuilt in the 20s and 30s by Lenin and Stalin to create the new order, the new structure of Russian society, the USSR. So kind of completely redressed the Russian Empire in new clothes. Those new clothes were dominated by the Marxism and Leninism and Stalinism. And then, following that restructuring, in the, like I said, depending on how you break it up, let's say that was the 30s and 40s. Then in the 50s, you have Stalin dies, Khrushchev comes into power, and you have the Khrushchev thaw. You have, this would be the equivalent of like the consciousness revolution of the 60s and 70s in the US, or 60s and 70s. And then following the thaw, you have the Brezhnev stagnation. Again, this kind of just matches up with fourth turning theory. And then following stagnation, you have a crisis period, this kind of watershed moment. And what happens at the end of the 90s? You have the breakup of the Soviet Union. You have communism following. You have a revolution from above and a huge crisis in the 90s where, again, Russia gets torn apart and a lot of bad stuff happens. And then following the crisis, you have a rebuilding. And that rebuilding has arguably happened in the last, and been happening in the last 20 years, where Russia has kind of reestablished itself as a major power to a large degree. Certainly, Russia now is in many ways almost incomparable with what it was in the 90s. So you seem to see that playing out. And if that's true, that would mean that Russia and the Western world are on different cycles. The cycles aren't synchronized, because Russia is still kind of in their restructuring phase, and the Western world is in its crisis phase. So, where to go from there? Do you have anything to say?
Just as a theory, as a possible idea of what's going on. I mean, it seems to have some power to it. There's something to it that's real, because like you've just been doing, you've been laying it out where we have specific examples where it does seem to map pretty closely. You know, nothing is exact to the year, but the overall trend for specific decades does match the theory. Mm-hmm. So we can use that as a heuristic going forward, you know, taking aside what, you know, as you had said before, where there's specific examples, you know, those may not be what actually happens, mm-hmm. because, I mean, those specific examples come from a specific time and a place and a specific trajectory where they see things going. But the nature of the future is that it's not happening yet. Mm-hmm. So you can only take a best guess, you know, based on where you are now. Yeah. So, you know, I forgive them their faulty predictions, because, you know, we're all trying to predict the future, and oftentimes we go very, very, you know, wrong mm-hmm. in our predictions. So, you know, no fault to them on that. But again, it's that there does seem to be something to it. And it's a bit of a meme at this point, where there is there is a specific meme that I'm thinking about, where it's like, good times create weak men create bad times,
there's a third one.
Bad times create good men, and good men create good times. So it's that there's the four pieces of that puzzle. So, I mean, like, that totally makes sense from a theoretical perspective. Mm-hmm. This just gives it an actual, like, time frame. So it's like, okay. Like, I can totally see that. Mm-hmm. And then beyond the theoretical level, if we want to get into James Lindsay's article on the Woke Revolution, well, he breaks that down into specific examples of how the woke revolution has been going on within America, most specifically. But it does have this the same kind of delineated periods for decades where you have specific infiltrations and specific introductions and situations, crises, events that shape the decade or two and builds upon itself to, I guess, in its own way, create a fourth turning of its own.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's what I liked about Lindsay's article. We'll include a link to it in the show description because he doesn't use these words, but the way I see what he's laid out in this article, he looks at these important kind of turning points in the last, since 2008, and trends before then, like trends before then in critical pedagogy and the rise of kind of woke critical theories in education and in academia, and then those trends, how they've provided the background and the kind of substructure for these events that have played out since 2008. And so the events that play out are, of course, well, maybe not, some of them maybe aren't that obvious, but the election of Barack Obama coinciding with the financial crisis, and then the shootings of, was it Trayvon Martin and
Trayvon
Michael
Martin.
Brown?
Yeah.
In 2013 and 2014? Yeah. 2013 was Trayvon Martin, and then August 2014 was Michael Brown, which led to the creation of Black Lives Matter, and which is very significant today. And then following that, the election of Donald Trump, 2015, then the entire presidency of Donald Trump, 2016 to 2020. And was there one more, or was that it? Oh, and then, of course, the big one during Trump's presidency was the death of George Floyd. Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at all of these events and then the reaction to these events, the thing that strikes me the most about, well, it seems to be getting more intense as you go along chronologically, is that the reaction to them seems, I wouldn't say complete, well, exaggerated to a very great degree. If these would have happened 20 years ago, there wouldn't have been the same reaction to them. If you just look at the election of Donald Trump, and as Lindsay points out, the emergence of Trump derangement syndrome, the reaction to Trump has been more extreme than anything Trump actually did. Mm-hmm. At least that's the way I see it. I don't know how you can. Well, I know how you can look at Trump's presidency and then come away with the reactions that have come out of it.
Yeah.
But they are objectively exaggerated, to say the very least. To understate the matter, it has been complete hysteria to something that really doesn't necessitate that kind of reaction. And the same thing with George Floyd. If you look at the people. Almost, he's a martyr. I mean, was it Pelosi that just recently, you know, thanked him for the sacrifice of his life, and that he sacrificed his life for civil rights and for human rights or something like that. But and the graffiti of Saint George, you know, Saint George Floyd with the halo, and it's one of those things that you shouldn't have to point out, because it should be obvious that, of course, it was a tragedy in its own sense that he died on that day in the circumstances that he did. But to sanctify like a person like George Floyd, it doesn't seem to match the situation.
It's not like he was...
like Martin Luther King.
Yeah, he wasn't Martin Luther King. He wasn't going out and actively like doing something to be a symbol. He wasn't trying to be a symbol. Like that's the thing. It's he just happened to die on a particular day in a particular circumstance that then got co-opted for other means and purposes. And like you say, like all of these little things are just completely out of proportion. One thing that sticks out of my mind is just the and James Lindsay talks about it in his article where the election of Donald Trump is seen as the rise of racism in America, mm-hmm. which doesn't like make sense to me at all, because you're coming from 8 years of Obama. He got elected and then reelected by the majority of Americans. How can you tell me that the majority of Americans are racist when they specifically do something that is anti-racist? Like that just like those are the two like very stark differences, where you have like the theory and the hysteria versus the reality and what's actually going on. And you can see the reaction being so disproportionate to what's actually going on. Mm-hmm. And so it's just a question of like, you know, why or how, and Fourth Turning kind of gives you that possible perspective as to why it is that there is a hysterical reaction or overreaction, mm-hmm. I guess you would say, to these, you know, specific things.
Mm-hmm. And he does point out in the election of Obama, he does point out that living in Tennessee, when Obama was elected, he did see like an outbreak of racism, right? And it was obvious. But he points out that it's not like that was the majority response, and it was examples like that that were upheld as the proof that like American society was systemically racist at that time. And but they weren't even using that kind of that language very very much at all 10 13 14 years ago. Mm-hmm. That language has only come about now because of Trump, because everything, this is the thing about all these sparks, all these events, is that for critical race theory, every event proves their point. Their ideology is such that any piece of evidence can be and is used as proof that they are correct. There's no disconfirming evidence possible.
Which is great about, as a criticism of it, where they criticize the Fourth Turning, or people will criticize the Fourth Turning as being something that cuts data to fit its model and theory. Like, I can't think of any better example than critical theory of something that completely just distorts whatever data is presented in front of it in order for fit the theory. So I'm just like, how can, like, you know, there's the two great examples of you know, just the Fourth Turning and critical theory, and mm-hmm. one clearly does something that they're accusing the Fourth Turning of way worse than the Fourth Turning, but it's still given credence as if it can predict mm-hmm. what's going on and why.
Yeah, and it does that because there's only ever one answer, and there's only ever one
racism.
Prediction, right? Yeah, so racism, any interaction, you know, like Lindsay likes to say, he quotes Robin DiAngelo, that it's not did racism manifest in this situation, it's how did racism manifest in this situation. Every interaction, every social interaction, every thought that you have, everything that happens has an element of racism. It's built into the structure of human reality. That's how these people see racism. And so no matter what happens, there will be a way of interpreting it as an expression of racism. And of course, this is it. On one level, it works because a lot of people buy it. A lot of people believe it. On the other hand, it really undercuts their own position because it trivializes actual racism. Mm-hmm. So when you're looking at these benign events and interactions and calling them racist, then it just seems to.
So when you say that there is a moral equivalence mm-hmm. between somebody who is a cashier who helps a white person first as opposed to a black person mm-hmm. for whatever reason, when you say that is racism and is morally equivalent to somebody who had gone out specifically found a black person and then beat them. Mm-hmm. If those are morally equivalent, like you say, it undercuts their position as to why racism is bad.
And it's even worse than that, because when Lindsay brings that up, he uses the example of, you know, a black person and a white person coming into a store at the same time, maybe a coffee shop, And because there's racism in every situation, the barista is trapped, right? So it's not mm-hmm. that it's not even that he picks the white person yeah. first. If he picks the black person first, that's because he's got these internalized. He's got this internal. Well, I don't even know the word.
He's trying to not appear racist,
right? But yeah, so he's got this internalized backwards racism or something because he sees the black person as inferior in some way. He uses his kind of white knight mentality to pander to the black person, and that's an expression of racism. So it's racist whether he picks the white person or the black person first. And so not only is there a moral equivalence between picking the white person first, there's a moral equivalence between choosing to serve the black person first and an act of actual like racist violence. Mm-hmm. So everything is racist. So that's the kind of crazy times that we're living in. At a time of mass hysteria. Now, this is what I wanted. This is the other cyclical theory that I wanted to get into, because Lobachevsky talks about a similar, well, it's almost the exact same thing in Ponerology. He essentially describes those four stages that we've been talking about. He uses slightly different terminology. He doesn't perfectly delineate them into four consecutive generations, but he talks about the cycle of good times and bad times, and in how in good times people get complacent, it leads to stagnation. And then in this period of good times and stagnation, there is an increase in social hysteria. This is the element that that isn't explicit when you see summaries of generation. I can never remember if it's generations or generational theory. Fourth turning. I haven't read the whole book, so I don't know if they talk about mass hysteria and how they fit that into their model. But in Lobachevsky's, that during good times and during the stagnation, there's a period of mass hysteria, of social hysteria. And then he says that about 25 years after the peak of mass hysteria is when you'll see a crisis. And that, he gives two numbers. He gives 25 years after the peak and about 10 years after that peak has hysteria has declined. But now I'm going to start something else and then circle back to that point. When Lobachevsky wrote his book in 1984, well, he came to the States in the late 70s, I think like 78 or 79, maybe even 77, 78, I think. And during the 80s, he observes in his book that coming from Eastern Europe and being thrown into American culture in the mid-80s, that, and not just him, but people like him who had come from Europe and who were old enough to remember, so this would be like octogenarians, old people that remembered what life was like in the first part of in the early 1900s, that people from Europe recognized in America of the 1980s what Europe had gone through in the early 1900s, which Lobachevsky points out was the last great peak of social hysteria, of mass hysteria in European civilization. And this is when you saw an almost epidemic of what today would be called mass psychogenic illness or mass hysteria. You had the actual epidemic of hysteria, which was, back then, it was kind of a diagnosis for a whole bunch of symptoms. Nowadays, we don't tend to use the word hysteria clinically anymore. At least psychiatrists don't. They use like somatoform disorders and conversion disorders and things like that. But basically, there was a mass outbreak of mental illness that was labeled as hysteria, and that's what Lobachevsky and others like him observed in the U.S. during the 1980s. And he said in his professional opinion, that was like the peak of hysteria was in the 80s. And what was happening in the 80s? Well, you had the mass outbreak of bulimia and anorexia. You had the satanic panic. You had and these were just what you might call like clinical things going on, multiple personality disorder. And that's in addition to the culture wars that broke out in the 80s and 90s. So there was a lot of weird stuff going on, mass hysteria-wise. And then when he got back to Poland, observing events from afar this time, by the late 90s, he said, well, it looks like that peak of hysteria is past. So by the late 90s, you know, that hysteria. Oh, and one other thing that was huge in the 80s was serial killers. After we watched the Richard Ramirez documentary, I think, also maybe the Ted Kaczynski one, I looked up the figures, and there's a chart of American serial killers, and it's like, it's pretty low. And then during the 80s, it's just like, woof, and then 90s to now, it drops off. Like, there was a huge spike of serial killers in the 1980s, but yeah, just incidentally. And so things did seem to level off during the 90s. And so if the peak was like mid 80s, let's say even like late 80s, then, well, just for easy math, let's say it was 1990. 20 years from 1990 was, well, just wait, 90 to 2000, or let's say 85. Yeah, let's just say 85 when Lobachevsky was writing. 2010 is 25 years from then. And 10 years after the pass after the decline of social hysteria, according to Lobachevsky's scheme here, let's say if you take 1998 when he was writing that about the decline in hysteria in American society, 10 years from 1998 was 2008, the financial crisis. Basically, it looks like, from where I stand, he's essentially seeing and describing the same things. He's got a slightly different terminology and way of measuring it, because he thinks that the hysterical cycle, the hysteroidal cycle, as he calls it, was around 200 years, around two centuries. But I think that if there's any truth to the fourth turning theory, that Lobachevsky's data might have just been, when he was looking at whatever historical examples he was looking at, and the people that he was following, because some of his professors in Poland at the time were big on to these cycles of history. And it could have just been that they were looking at two cycles, that like a period of really great hysteria that led to a big crisis, and then maybe the second one a century later just got kind of lost because, for whatever reason, those sparks didn't ignite into the same like turmoil that it did in the 200 years. It would be like looking at I think that's
what I guess. You could say, looking at a stock market example, you could have like a run up in a certain stock that goes up to like 100, mm-hmm. you know, starting at $10 and it goes up to 100. And then on the next, I guess like a bull run, it goes from 50 to, or like 30 to 80. So there's still a huge run-up, but it's not quite as big.
Yeah. Yeah, and it could just be that, like Lobachevsky himself says elsewhere in his book, in this section, he's talking about how societies can have, and cultures can have, different levels of resistance to these types of phenomena, so they can weather the storm. So from one cycle to the next, a society might weather the fourth turning comparatively well compared to 100 years later, when they might just fall apart. So it's not like, again, it's not like it's a total repeat of history. It's certain trends, and it's certain trends with certain characteristics that play themselves out depending on a whole lot of variables. So, for example, in the US now, I might get some details here wrong just because I don't know enough of the history, but if you look at the last crisis period in the United States, you had the Great Depression and World War II. The Great Depression was arguably a big crisis, and World War II as well, but World War II was never actually fought on American soil. It was a foreign war, except for Pearl Harbor. So American society basically did survive. You know, it's not like American society fell apart like Russian society fell apart during the Russian Revolution. But America was able to The United States was able to kind of rebuild in the 50s and create, you know, create good times, essentially, you know, like the 50s, and create the, essentially rule the world for the next 70 years.
Well, it was like they had a, they got to have the crisis by proxy, almost, because they didn't, like you said, it wasn't fought on American soil. It was fought over in Europe and on Russian soil to a large extent. So they were able to, I guess, have exposure to the crisis and all of the things that led up to the crisis and all of the bad things about, you know, what had led up to it, while also maintaining their distance to be able to examine what was wrong and build something stronger to withstand that. And so thereby have its own kind of revitalization and crisis without the disastrous effects of the crisis.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So, according to these schemes, these frameworks for looking at history, Strauss and Howe, William Strauss and Neil Howe, I think those are their names, predicted that the fourth turning would start around 2007, 2008, and that's when the financial crisis happened. And then predicted that it would, nowadays, only one of them is alive now. I think Strauss is the one that's still alive. And he predicts that this fourth turning, the crisis period, will end in around 2030, something around there. So all these events that are happening in this current time have the potential to essentially destroy civilization, destroy society, in, you know, to a greater or lesser degree. And the thing about these cycles is that they can and are synchronized between various countries. So it looks like the entire Western world shares the same cycle. And so what happens in one country could affect others, and different things could happen in different countries, but it's all going to blow up to some degree. So that's, with that in mind, looking at it in terms of what Lindsay brings up in his Rise of the Woke Cultural Revolution article, is you can make some predictions based on these trends. Just like the rise of critical theory in education and in academia in the 80s and 90s and the 2000s has created this climate today where it arguably influences every aspect of Western society, from education, from kindergarten to graduation and getting your PhD, to the media, to every corporation, every corporate environment, every business environment, churches, government. It's basically followed the outline of Gramsci's revolutionary theory, which was to basically artificially infect all of these institutions, law, education, religion, can't remember all six of them, but to insinuate yourself and your revolutionary movement and your ideology into all of these institutions. And that it's a new form of revolution. That's actually one of the other things that I wanted to get to, is one of the ways that these crises manifest is through revolutions. And there are different types, but there are different types of revolution. Like the Russian Revolution was a revolution from below. A revolutionary movement, a group of hardcore activists that get enough popular support that they are able to tear down the existing power structure and replace it with one of their own. So the Bolsheviks were able to do that in the late teens and early 20s. There's also a revolution from above. This is when power changes hands through revolutionary means, not through the people, but through, let's say, a faction or someone within the existing power structure. So it doesn't require a revolutionary movement from below. It might be motivated by a revolution from below, or even in reaction to a revolution from below. But there's at least some continuity, some, how to put it, observable continuity in like the structure of government, and it can be very secretive, behind the scenes, like conspiratorial. Like it can happen without you really noticing it. A revolution from above. And what we see playing out in the United States these days, in the last several years, can arguably be called a revolution from above. That's what Gordon Hahn is observing, as well as Angelo Codevilla. That seems to be what's playing itself out. That's actually what happened in Russia in the 90s too, which is another story. Gordon Hahn writes about that in one of his books. But you've also, now this is another kind of revolution. What seems to be going on is like it's a combination of revolution from below and revolution from above, where when the revolution takes place, it's not necessarily that this group of revolutionaries that form a section of Western society will like rise up and take power from the existing power structure. The way it's playing itself out is that it has been a revolution through the institutions. I'll lay out some of the things that have been happening. There has been a revolution through the institutions, the infiltration and the influence and infection of institutions by activists, that to the point where they're now in control of these institutions, or at least they have vast huge amounts of control and influence. So that's what they've done in churches and in education and in law and in politics too. So the combination is that the same process is going on within the existing government power structure, to the point where people in power can just declare themselves to be on the side of the revolution, and no violent revolution seems to have happened. It's just, oh, well, you know, we're now in power. It's kind of, and you could say something kind of similar happened with, not exactly, but something similar happened with the Nazi revolution, because the Hitler got in power through democratic means, but at the same time, it was a revolution. It's not like Hitler and the Nazis tore down the existing, like, you know, violently invaded and tore down the existing German government or power structure. They got in as a political party. And so there's an element of that too. It's kind of like we see elements of all these different types of revolutions happening in these last few years. And I've got to sneeze.
Well, I'll just say that that was exactly what I was thinking about as you were kind of laying out the two different examples, was that it is both, because coming from like the corporate example, where Lego just came out with their new "Everyone is awesome." I don't even know if it's a line of things or if it's just like one particular like object or set, you know, Lego set, where, you know, it's non-gender conformist. I can't even think of the jargon to use to describe it. But it's just like a rainbow of Lego characters. And so that's coming from the corporate side. There's also the infection of the Southern Baptist Convention with Article or Resolution 9, I think is what it's called, where they talk about how they want to start proclaiming critical theory and critical race theory as part of its doctrine in order to lead people to Christ in some kind of weird way that doesn't make any kind of sense. And also there's the infection in politics with Biden and his administration being all about equity. So there is this infection from the top, and there's not been a revolution, but there has been, in a sense, because we're under Trump, the infection was still ongoing, but there was a power structure or a power base that had grassroots support coming, you know, towards Trump, and Trump also, you know, kind of helping people that supported him in pushing back against it. Whereas, you know, through quote unquote democratic means, end quote.
Fortified democracy.
Fortified democracy. Now we have Joe Biden and, you know, his group of, you know, woke people trying to push all of these things from the top. And then at the same time, too, because of George Floyd, St. George Floyd, may he rest in peace. You have all of the riots and whatnot continuing to move forward. And so there is both. And that's one thing that I've been wondering about is like, how far will it go? You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. Is there going to be a violent revolution, or is it just going to, are the people at the top going to continue to just kind of like placate and play the role? Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, that's why it's hard to predict. But it, that's an issue. Yeah, that's one of those issues that we've talked about several times on the show, and that comes up in the guests that we interview and the books that we read. Like, it's essentially the way I've phrased it is the question of, is the future going to be Brave New World or 1984? Because mm-hmm. I use that as kind of like a symbol for a number of different things, not just the form that the government takes, like 1984, a totally brutal system and government to live under. It's kind of like Stalinism times 1,000, or is it like Brave New World, where everyone is convinced that they're happy and content and there's no real need for force or violence? Everyone just complies willingly and meekly. How is it going to play out? So that's, you see that question in, well, there's, that also relates to, how's the revolution going to play out? Is it going to be this nice, cozy, fun revolution without making any real waves like we've been seeing? Or is there going to be like, or will there be something like a civil war? That's a question. And Rod Dreher talked about this in his book in Live Not by Lies, when he kind of, if I remember correctly, he kind of predicts in the book that totalitarianism in the Western world will be soft totalitarianism. It won't achieve the levels of brutality that, for instance, communism did in most of the countries that it took root in the 20th century, or like Nazi Germany, that it will kind of resemble Brave New World more than 1984. But that just reminded me of something that I wanted to add in there. I talked about how Lobachevsky talked about in the 80s how he and like the older generation were seeing the similarities between American culture and what was going on in Europe in the early 1900s before the outbreak of revolution and world war. And so that was in the 80s, 30 something years ago. And there's a similar observation, but this one's from Zbigniew Janowski's book, came out this year, Homo Americanus, The Rise of Totalitarian Democracy in America. I just want to read the first couple sentences, because things have kind of changed. He writes, "Only few Americans seem to understand that we, here in the United States, are living in a totalitarian reality, or one that is quickly approaching it. Any visitor from a country formerly behind the totalitarian Iron Curtain quickly notices that the lack of freedom in today's America is, in many respects, greater than what he had experienced under socialism. The other thing that our visitor notices is that 30 years after Eastern European countries shook off the yoke of communism, the former socialist countries are in some respects freer than the U.S. It goes on and it goes on. Now, this is also an observation that it's basically how Rod Dreher introduces his book, Live Not by Lies, is that he was hearing the exact same thing from some of his Eastern European friends that were saying that, like, in these last 5 to 10 years, they're saying this is exactly like what we experienced under communism. So put those two together, you have a group of Eastern Europeans in the 80s saying, oh, this is just like what we experienced before the rise of communism, versus these last 5 years you guys, you know, we lived through this. This is what's going on. So that's a hint to me that this process is already far along, and that, like he puts it, it's already totalitarian to a degree, or at the very least, it is quickly approaching that level. And another poll, Richard Legutko makes the same observation in his book *Demon and Democracy*, and they're not the only ones. There is something weird going on, and it is identifiable. Like, it can be traced. James Lindsay traces it from a certain angle and sees certain things. The polls see it in, I wouldn't say a different way. Well, in some ways a different way. But they're kind of tracing it back, like Yanofsky here, tracing it back to the actual flaws in the philosophy and practice of, like, liberal democracy itself, and how those weaknesses have led to how it is manifesting today. Lindsay is more focused on this kind of caricature of liberal democratic thought, which is critical theory, which comes out of neo-Marxism, well, is neo-Marxism, but nowadays it's like wokeness is this amalgamation of postmodernism and critical studies. So you can trace this specific genealogy of these philosophies, but the reality on the ground is that there has been in essence a cultural revolution in Western society through education and youth and academics and the media and et cetera. One institutions we forgot to mention was the military. Military, same thing going on there. So yeah, that's what we have to look forward to is, we're already so far along in this process, it seems. That for me, it's just a matter of kind of just watching.
Yeah.
Kind of like it's kind of like a movie that you just gotta watch play out and then play whatever role you have to when it gets to that point and see what happens.
Yeah, that's I agree. From where I'm sitting, it does seem like we're fairly far along in the process. Well, I mean, it's an interesting, like we were talking about where in the 80s, there was the older generation saying like, hey, we've been through this in terms of like all of the lead up to the revolution. And now the difference is they're like, this is the revolution.
Like the revolution's already happened.
Yeah. So it's scary in that sense that it's like, it's already here. It's already now. In some sense, it's already too... Well, we'll say that it's not too late to stop it from going full Nazi, for lack of a better word, or full Brave New World. But it's too far along to stop it from creating a lot of mayhem and a lot of suffering, unfortunately. And so, like you said, the best thing that we can do is observe, watch, wait, play whatever role comes before you, and deal with what comes to just see the thing through to the end and hope that, not only are you able to survive, but to not get crushed in a spiritual sense along the way too, because that's another aspect to it. And then it's almost a silver lining in a certain respect, because the hard times create good men aspect of it. And I'll go back to Erturul for a second, and so going back to Erturul and Ibn Arabi having his discussion with Erturul about how the sword isn't forged by gentle massages and loving caresses. It has to be hammered, and it has to be thrown into the fire, and it has to be hammered again, and then thrown back into the fire. And it's through that process of struggle and strife that something good within you can be forged and is stronger because of it. So, yeah, in a sense, this is a bit of a silver lining, because, you know, you can be so much stronger than you ever would have been if you didn't have to face these things, because it's one of the aspects of life that, you know, is unavoidable. Like, objective reality is unavoidable in certain senses, and you can get pretty far in your own growth as a human being, just, you know, of your own volition. But when you, I'll use an example here, where if you want to be the best runner that you can be, like, you can train hard and you can do a lot of things, and you'll get pretty far. But if you have a driver of that motivation, where there's somebody trying to, you know, run faster than you in a competition, in a race, well, then you just have to try that much harder, because you can't control that person, and you don't know how hard they're going to work. So then you have to work harder than that guy.
Or it's like in martial arts, if you're training by yourself, mm-hmm. and only by yourself, then you get thrown in a sparring match. It's like you realize you don't know what you're doing.
Yeah.
You actually have to spar in order to to advance in your skills and your ability.
Yeah. It's not like you're trying to be better than yourself. Mm-hmm. You're trying to be better than the next guy that's going to kick your ass if you're not better than him.
Yeah. Which at the same time is you're trying to be better than yourself. You're always trying to be better than yourself, but without an external situation in order to actually test that out with, mm-hmm. you know, with an external reality, then
you don't really know how strong you are.
Yeah. Okay. I think that's good. I'll end it there. So we'll give links to the books that we've discussed today in the show description. So check them out, because one of the things that Lobachevsky says is just being aware of what's happening, like the specifics of what's happening, and we haven't even, you know, touched the surface of all the dynamics going on. That's why I recommend reading his book. But just knowing these dynamics has the effect of, it's almost like a real vaccine, a psychological vaccine that immunizes you against the effects of it. And one example he gives is that in the period of high Stalinism in Poland in the late 40s, early 50s, as a psychologist, he noticed like what he described as psychophysiological shock symptoms, essentially like these traumatic responses to the imposition of this new form of government, and that these symptoms, some antidepressants of the time worked on these symptoms and helped people essentially survive and got through this dark new reality. But after 10, 15 years, they'd even forgotten like that they needed those antidepressants back then, because they'd learned to adapt to the situation, how to navigate it. Because once they have, well, that's just adaptation. It's kind of like a naturally acquired immunity. But to actually have the understanding of what's going on, to actually be able to see what's going on, is that effect, it's kind of like that effect, an order of magnitude greater or exponentially greater. So,
well, I guess in that respect, then it's you know, if you're walking through a forest and you don't know where you are and you're lost, mm-hmm. you freak out,
yeah,
because you're lost in the woods and you don't know where you're going. Yeah. But if you had a handy roadmap that you were studying exactly. beforehand, and you knew where you were going, even at least an approximation, mm-hmm. and how to, I think more importantly, how to get out, or at least like deal with it. If you're stuck there for a while, like if you have some survival training, mm-hmm. You're not going to freak out, because you know what you're dealing with and you know how to deal with it. Right. So I think in a very similar way that's, you know, what this stuff is good for.
Yeah, and that's the premise of Peterson's Maps of Meaning, right? Is that in an encounter with chaos, it is disintegrative and it is chaotic because it is unknown. Mm-hmm. But once you have a map of meaning, once you're able to map that reality and place it within a framework where it's understandable, it loses the element of chaos, and it becomes navigable. It becomes something in which you can maneuver and in which you can survive. So, yeah. So I hope some people get their truth vaccines. I hear they're quite effective. So, thanks everyone. Take care, and we'll see you later.